Cafe, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on listener-supported KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Pacifica Radio for Southern California and beyond.
Welcome to Gray Zone Radio. I'm your host and the editor of thegrayzone.com, Max Blumenthal. Today we'll be picking up on our regular coverage of the Ukraine proxy war as the war takes a turn for the worse and U.S. mainstream media begins to acknowledge that the U.S., and not only its Ukraine proxies, have been bogged down in a battle that it cannot possibly win. We'll also talk about the 20th anniversary of two landmark moments, two terrible moments that helped shape me as a journalist and also shape many of my colleagues at the Gray Zone. First, we'll talk about the 20th anniversary of the crime of the century, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, how it ravaged the Middle East, and how it sent me and many other anti-war journalists on the path that we're currently on. Then we'll also talk about the 20th anniversary of the killing by apartheid Israel of the courageous American activist Rachel Corrie in Rafah inside the occupied Gaza Strip in 2003, almost 20 years ago last week, and how her legacy shaped my generation of anti-Zionists and inspired Palestinians and people around the world to continue to fight for their liberation. But now the media is starting to concede to reality to some degree because of the Battle of Bakhmut. Battle of Bakhmut. A few months ago, I was mocked for stating what seemed to be obvious, which was that it was not going Ukraine's way, and that for them to constantly reinforce and send so many men there was going to deplete their most experienced divisions and lead to a possible munitions shortage. And that has happened. And now the New York Times and Washington Post have come in and acknowledged this reality, which seems to pour cold water on the whole victory narrative we were hearing just a few months ago, that Ukraine was on its way toward a total victory. I mean, just a few weeks ago, you had former U.S. generals going on like Fareed Zakaria's Sunday show calling for the retaking of Crimea as if that was somehow possible. So here's the New York Times. Ukraine burns through ammunition in Bakhmut, putting future fights at risk. The military is using thousands of artillery shells a day as it tries to hold the eastern city, which could jeopardize a planned springtime campaign because they need the artillery. The U.S., it goes on to state that the U.S. production capacity is not going to be able to replenish Ukraine's stocks in time for the spring when the ground in the Donbass hardens. And by that point, Russia could have pushed through Ukrainian defenses and seized all of these cities around it. And there's a really interesting photo here. If you read this caption right here, it's very small. It says a photo of a screen showing Ukrainian military drone footage of Bakhmut in January. Bakhmut is a small city, but it provides road access farther east and has become symbolically important for both sides. So, okay, symbolically important is the language that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin used to try to diminish the importance of a Russian victory in and around this area, which will probably decide the fate of the entire Donbass. But it also says that it provides road access farther east here. In other words, acknowledging at the same time the contradictory reality that it is strategically important for both sides, because that road access leads to the rest of these cities around the Donbass and is where Ukraine's defensive fortifications have been prepared for the past 8 years. And they're just being chewed up completely by Russian artillery. Bakhmut is now basically in a cauldron, and the cauldron is heating up by the day. And it's said that the last road that provides supplies to Ukrainian forces is about to be closed. And then here we have the Washington Post acknowledging just a few days before and we have an ad for Bosley Hair Clinic. I don't know if they're sending me a message there. Ukraine short of skilled troops and munitions as losses, pessimism grow. And the first paragraph says it all. The quality of Ukraine's military force, once considered a substantial advantage over Russia, has been degraded by a year of casualties that have taken many of the most experienced fighters off the battlefield. That's an interesting editorial choice. Many of the most. So in other words, most.
Yeah.
Leading some Ukrainian officials to question Kyiv's readiness to mount a much anticipated spring offensive. It's the same narrative, almost the same wording as the New York Times. It quotes Ukrainian commanders actually stating that they have lost 4/5 of their experienced fighters, and they're bringing in green fighters from the cities who are basically being picked up by military police and hauled off to the front with almost no experience. So what does that mean for the war? And what does it say about the press that have been kind of selling the American public on an imminent Ukraine victory, Aaron?
Yeah, more than 1 year into the war, we finally get some rare admissions of reality. And this has been predicted all along by people like Scott Ritter and Doug McGregor, who, you know, back in August and September, when Ukraine had that victory in Kharkiv and routing Russia from around that region, there was so much triumphalism and so many declarations that Russia was finished and that Ukraine was on the march. But what people like Ritter and McGregor pointed out was that Ukraine expended so much force, so much material, burned through so much ammo, and sacrificed so many people to take back areas around Kharkiv that weren't that strategically important. And they did that for PR, because if you look at the reporting from that time, it came out in the New York Times that the offensive in Kharkiv, and this is again the summer, in last summer and in September, it came out of Zelensky really wanting a PR offensive to show a victory so he could basically have something to show for with all these billions of dollars he's getting in U.S. weapons. And so that's what that resulted from. And he sacrificed a lot of people for that. At the same time, though, if the U.S. officials were telling the New York Times, and this was buried at the end of articles, things like the most dangerous moments are yet to come because Russia hasn't really taken the gloves off yet. So Russia did shortly after that, and now we're seeing the result. And now we're because of that, we're finally getting accounts like this in the Post, which, by the way, is devastating. That article, I recommend people read it. It's devastating. One unit commander talks about basically losing every single person in his battalion, which numbers in the hundreds of people, that he's like the only person left in his unit. So losing so many comrades. And, you know, I think Ukraine surprised many people, including myself, with how hard they fought. I mean, you have to give them that. Like this, they put up a fight that I didn't personally expect. And of course, they've been helped by an infusion of tens of billions of dollars worth of U.S. military equipment and NATO military equipment. But now we're seeing the result of the U.S. strategy of, in the words of Lindsey Graham, using Ukraine to, quote, fight to the last person. Now we're seeing Ukraine fighting to the last person, and it's devastating. Think about the long-term impact. I mean, aside from the horrible loss of life, the long-term impact on generations of Ukrainians. And this is a result of a U.S. strategy, I think, that is rather than allowed for diplomacy, sabotage diplomacy, and tried to fuel this fight and gave everybody the wrong impression that Ukraine could win.
Well, this is Zelensky's failure, ultimately. This is on him, all of these deaths. And it was, as you said, it was all about trying to score another PR win. And remember who he's fighting. Okay, there are Russian regular units involved, but it's primarily a private mercenary company, the Wagner Group. It's not like Russia's throwing the full brunt of its military against the Ukrainian military. And the Ukraine is sending its best forces in. It is sending in forces that were trained by the British military and by NATO. We talked about last week, one of its most famous commanders, Da Vinci from Right Sector, was killed there. Major units are going down and being chewed up. And this battle and this war in general is not necessarily about, it's not all about taking territory. Those who said, oh, Russia tried to take all of Ukraine and Kyiv with its initial offensive in the Kyiv Oblast, they don't understand necessarily what the strategy is or how it's emerging. Yevgeny Prigozhin, of the founder of the Wagner Group, said this is about chewing up their materiel, them spending their munitions, and especially killing as many of their men as possible. And that was Ulysses Grant's strategy against the Confederacy. He told Lincoln, I want to go in and destroy the Confederate army, not necessarily take cities. And that's what he did. And once the Confederate army was out of its fighters, they were much better fighters. We're seeing that from the Ukrainian military. They're good fighters. They have a lot more morale, apparently, than Russians. They believe they're fighting for their homeland. Once they're gone, and they can't be replaced. So I don't know what they're going to do. And this, and but this also speaks to the quality of the U.S. media. This is how the New York Times was selling this war just a few months ago to the American public. This is basically a declaration of Ukrainian military victory in a major front page spread in the New York Times, Inside Russia's Military Catastrophe. This was published basically
on the daily, on the podcast, The Daily.
Yeah, on The Daily. So you get like a, you know, just orgasmic celebration of the Ukrainian military. You can see this blue and white flag flanks the headline. This is the flag you see all over elite liberals' homes around Washington, D.C. And I guess you pretty much see it on all cities in the coast. There's so many people involved in this. This is like a Hollywood production. Today, we hear from Russian soldiers and explore why a military superpower keeps making the same mistakes and why, despite it all, its soldiers keep going back to fight because they're just stupid, culturally backward people. It couldn't be because they're actually defending their country against NATO and that they've been besieged for over 100 years, that the U.S. actually invaded Russia towards the end of World War One and the Midnight War that slaughtered thousands and thousands. No, none of that history matters. It's that the Russians are culturally backward slaves. They're Slavs and they're slaves to Putin. That's how it portrays them. And now, well, what happened to that article? What happened to that narrative? It's gone. And so the U.S. press has been lying to the public and the public doesn't understand. And that's why there's so little pressure in Congress on the administration to stop, to start rolling this back.
And the tragedy is that Ukraine is going to be left with a deal that is far worse than it could have gotten early on in the war. When you had these early peace talks in the first month of the war, brokered by Turkey, brokered by Israel, you know, according to all the reports, Russia was willing to withdraw to its pre-invasion lines, in exchange for basically Crimea being taken off the table and Ukraine pledging to not join NATO and some sort of commitments on demilitarization. So basically not placing offensive weapons within striking range of Russian territory. And I don't think Ukraine will get a good deal as that, because now Russia's formally annexed more territory, and I don't think it's going to give up the parts of the Donbass that want to join Russia, obviously. So it's just it's so senseless, all this loss of life. And I do think there will be, I mean, if I'm predicting, I do think there'll be an effort to actually do a spring offensive. And there are troops that have been trained outside of Ukraine by NATO that they're going to bring in. But for what? No, does anyone seriously think that it's going to make a difference at this point? I don't know. From where I sit, I don't.
And Putin himself, not a credible source in the U.S., even though he was overseeing negotiations or attempted negotiations, said that Boris Johnson and came in and into Kiev in March or April and told Zelensky to back off.
Yeah.
The whole point of the Russian advance towards Kiev, it was never intended to take the city. It would have been a military disaster. They knew that, was to freak out the Ukrainian government and the West and force them to come to the table and then to just deal with the Donbass region. And it was a failed strategy because they decided to go for total victory, even though they couldn't define it. And what they wound up with is, according to the Washington Post and the New York Times, and I don't know if this number is true or real, because the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense is closely guarding this more than anything, it's 100,000 dead or wounded. Yeah. Than the Ukrainian. I mean, that's a staggering number.
Yeah.
So they could have all been spared. I think it was always going to go this way. So we have, you know, freakouts taking place by one of the biggest regime change fanatics on US TV, Christiane Amanpour, over this reality. But she also she's been projecting the image of Ukrainian victory, along with Kaja Kallas of Estonia, who is just like this complete NATO hand puppet. Like, she's the alternative Sanna Marin.
So let me just talk about the latest reports from the front line. There is a very alarming interview and report from the Washington Post on the Eastern Front, quoting a Ukrainian, I believe a lieutenant or a colonel, basically saying that we do not have enough people. We do not have enough trained troops anymore. We're losing our best people. We are not getting all that's being promised by you all in the West in time for right now. How have you heard this? And how alarmed does that make you feel?
That is frustrating, and we have heard that as well, and that's why some weeks ago I made the proposal on the European level to do this, you know, use this same mechanism as we did with the vaccines, that we provide the funds and the European Commission will directly procure the ammunition so that the defense...
It's amazing. She links the Ukraine proxy war directly to the pandemic and vaccine production, as if it's just like getting needles out and getting them in people's arms, getting artillery into Ukrainian guns to kill Russians. That's just an amazing metaphor she's making, or she's actually citing their success in producing vaccines for the big pharma companies with state procurement as a precedent or as a blueprint for what they need to do to save the Ukrainian military effort. Never will she say we need to negotiate. She will never say that. Then that'll be the end of this NATO stooge.
This industry could also boost their production. What is the problem is that, you know, the military industry in Russia is working in three shifts, whereas the defense industry in Europe has not boosted its production.
Yeah, I wonder what's going on there. Maybe it could be that European countries don't have the industrial base of Russia, and that Russia is actually working three shifts because it's directly defending its own strategic depth and national security, whereas Europe is not even directly involved except for Ukraine, which has doesn't have the kind of military industry that can do that. And the US is now using this story as the basis for a Pentagon push, a lobbying push that will fall on our backs as US taxpayers to pay an additional $30 billion to increase their munition production capacity simply to supply the Ukrainian military. That's another $30 billion from us to Ukraine. And of course, the arms industry, the makers of these howitzers.
And what was this all about? This was about, you know, chewing up Russian military, you know, killing as many Russians as possible. But not just that, also destroying Russia's economy in the hopes that would lead to regime change. That was the ultimate goal here by the U.S. I mean, Biden made that clear when a year ago he was in Poland and he said, for God's sakes, this man cannot remain in power. And that was the goal.
Sorry to interrupt, but Melanie Joly, the Canadian foreign minister, has just said our goal is definitely regime change in Russia.
So yeah, there we go. So that was the plan. And they thought they could do that because of U.S. control of the global financial system. And Biden was bragging about how the ruble is now rubble and these sanctions were going to cripple Russia's economy. And all they've gotten for that was, Russia's GDP has shrunk, but they're still doing very well in some areas. And the Russian economy has totally weathered the storm. So what else do they have? All they have is Ukrainian bodies to sacrifice.
And well, they've gotten more for that, Aaron, is that they've gotten boomerang sanctions on themselves and accelerated the process of de-dollarization. I mean, they froze $300 billion of Russian assets in Russian reserves in Western banks. And what does that do? It delegitimizes the Western financial system because the elites from countries that fear they might be targeted are going to turn east toward China, or the Saudis, for example, who've been targeted for human rights violations by the Biden administration. They're going to turn away from the U.S. And now you have China's government buying oil from Saudi Arabia in renminbi because of the illegal piracy of the U.S. just seizing money from people simply because they're citizens of a country they're targeting. It's not working out well for the U.S. It's not working out well in the long run, and it's not working out well in the short run. And so a few weeks ago, I think in two successive live streams, I'd raised the possibility that a victory or the routing of the Ukrainian military in Bakhmut and the advance of Russia's military through the defensive lines in Donbass, which would lead to total Russian and what you would call separatist control over the Donbass, would cause such a panic in Washington that there would be calls for direct military intervention. And now we're seeing that not over this directly, but over an event where a Russian MiG downed or basically dumped its fuel on a U.S. drone that just happened to get lost over the Black Sea. I don't know what it was doing there. It was really defending our homeland over the Black Sea. But now we're hearing calls for World War III, Aaron.
Yeah, and of course, what was that U.S. drone doing there? It's collecting intelligence to give to Ukraine, because the U.S. quietly, or not so quietly, I guess, anymore, has been, you know, not just supplying Ukraine with all these weapons, but directing its targeting, giving it coordinates for things to target and giving it intelligence for use in the war, because the U.S. is a belligerent in this war. So it's fair to assume that the U.S. drone over the Black Sea was collecting intelligence for the Ukraine proxy war effort. Russia, for the first time that we know of, finally downs it, although they've certainly not stopped many other drone flights for the same purpose. And that sparks this new freakout in Washington, where some of the biggest war hawks, like Lindsey Graham, are calling for a response or some sort of confrontation.
They shot down our drone. What should our answer be?
Well, we should hold them accountable and say that if you ever get near another U.S. set flying in international waters, your airplane would be shot down. What would Ronald Reagan do right now? He would start shooting Russian planes down if they were threatening our assets. American foreign, they shot down our drone. What should our...
Well, yeah. So he basically called for World War III. Then we have... Hannity opened the show with basically a call for World War III. And Hannity's been just the anti-Tucker since the beginning.
And let me say one thing. Graham said, what would Reagan do? I hate to say this, but I'd rather have Reagan in the White House right now than Biden, because Reagan negotiated arms control with Russia. And they eliminated an entire class of nuclear weapons. Not that Reagan was not a massive war criminal with so much innocent blood on his hands, obviously. But when it comes to the existential issue of confrontation with then the Soviet Union, he actually negotiated a really important arms control treaty, the INF treaty. And they came close to actually an agreement on abolishing all nuclear weapons, which got sabotaged by Reagan's aides. But I hate to say this, it's not a positive reflection of Reagan, but I'd rather have Reagan right now in the White House than Joe Biden. Because look
at these people. I'm glad you pointed that out. What would Reagan have done? Well, Reagan was an enthusiastic anti-communist who helped pioneer the proxy war as a strategy against the Soviet Union, not pioneer it, but really took it to the next level.
Oh yeah.
Of course, it was Brzezinski who launched the Afghan proxy war to weaken the Soviet Union, the so-called bear trap. But Reagan really picked up where he left off in Central America, Afghanistan, Mozambique, and on and on. But towards the end of the Reagan era, and this also spoke to the influence of Nancy Reagan, he not only got rid of a class of nuclear weapons, he got rid of a class of neocons that were embedded in his Pentagon, the Team B neocons, Richard Perle and these characters. They started out in the Reagan administration and he threw them out because they wanted him to escalate against Russia to build up America's nuclear stocks and actually possibly directly confront the Soviet Union. So ultimately, a president is going to have to confront the Lindsey Grahams, or there will be a possible nuclear confrontation.
And apparently, and this could just be complete propaganda, because so much about Reagan was falsified to make it look as if he was on top of it, and really he was out of it, and he was just an actor reading a script. But apparently, there's a story about him watching some movie about a nuclear apocalypse and being very scared by that, and that helped prompt him to negotiate. Yep. With the Soviet Union. And it is true, he had people around him. I mean, his U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union was Jack Matlock, who's one of the most now outspoken critics in the U.S. of the new Cold War with Russia. And there's no one of that caliber in the U.S. diplomatic ranks now, at least not that we know of. So, I mean, it sounds crazy because Reagan was so horrible. But again, it just speaks to how deranged the Biden cabinet is now and the people running.
Exactly. It's Gray Zone Radio. I'm your host, Max Blumenthal. You've been listening to our coverage of the Ukraine proxy war, along with my colleague Aaron Mate. We now turn to the 20th anniversary of the crime of the century, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and a continued discussion from our recent live stream. Bush is not really remembered well today. He eventually dropped to 20% approval rating by 2005 after winning the election. But here's how the war began. This was really the first images we saw of war on Iraq, and this is Baghdad. This is shock and awe. He was celebrated by as part of the beginning of the pacification campaign, because these were attacks on Iraqi government buildings. It's as if someone, a foreign army, blew up the Department of Treasury, they blew up the Department of Defense, they blew up the Department of Agriculture, they blew up the Department of Education. And they thought that the Iraqi people were going to celebrate having their government blown up by a foreign neocolonial army. Now, when shock and awe took place, I was outside at the Westwood Federal Building. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I was protesting. I protested from the first day. I also protested Bush's election with a very tiny group of people in Los Angeles because it was a stolen election. So I guess I was one of the original election deniers. When 9/11 happened, it was just straight up stolen. When 9/11 took place, I knew that the US was going to go in and have a phony war with some Arab state. It all just seemed completely obvious to me. But many of the Democrats I knew supported it when it first began. And then they sort of parted ways with Bush as the war started to go south and American soldiers were killed and the insurgency began, as was completely predictable. And it turned out that he lied about WMD and that, you know, but it was all obvious from the beginning that this was going to take place. It was going to be a disaster. And I protested along with a small group of people outside the Westwood Federal Building. I remember a line of sheriffs, LA County sheriffs, drove by us. There were also many police who had infiltrated the crowd. There were these big, burly, roided up guys with crew cuts holding answer anti-war signs in the corner. And a woman held up a sign that said, "Law is not war." And a cop looked at it, the lieutenant, and he gave her a thumbs up. And it suggested to me that there was going to be more anti-war opposition in the country than I think the elites and the media elite understood. But for me, the war in Iraq was seminal. It transformed me. It sent me on this journey eventually in journalism, which I think was delayed by the fact that Bush era liberalism meant opposition to the Iraq war, and that liberal NGOs like Move On, which we now understand is just like phony Blue Anon groups, were turning out the Democratic masses to these huge anti-war rallies. And so I was under the belief that that there was a wing of the Democratic Party, or that the Democratic base was anti-war. And then when Obama came in, we saw that that was just simply not the case. He co-opted and destroyed whatever was left of the anti-war movement. But that was my entree into anti-war politics, and also into having contact with people who were organizing Palestine solidarity actions, you know, challenging my concept of liberal Zionism being the right way to engage with Israel. We'll talk about that in a second. But Aaron, I mean, reflecting back on the Iraq war, how did it impact you as a journalist?
By the way, in terms of the Democratic Party and the space for anti-war dissent, then I'm pretty sure Nancy Pelosi voted against the Iraq war, right? Back then?
She did,
right? So imagine Nancy Pelosi, who's now in complete lockstep with neocons. Back then, she allowed herself to be anti-war. And that speaks to what you're talking about. That was a time when the Democratic Party gave the illusion of having space for not just people like Dennis Kucinich, but even people like Nancy Pelosi coming out against the Iraq war. Imagine Nancy Pelosi voting against a war now. I mean, all she does is promote them. But in terms of how this impacted me as a journalist, I was living in Montreal at the time, so I wasn't as, you know, wrapped up in the U.S. media, but I just remember watching with awe as just the entire U.S. media except for a few places like Democracy Now, were in lockstep with what the Bush administration was saying. And there was no, you could read the reporting, you could see how bad it was. And you could see the feedback loop of U.S. officials leaking something to the Times and then citing the Times or the Post as evidence for why we had to go to war in Iraq. And of course, the complete servitude of Tony Blair and what a scam British liberalism showed itself to be, because Labour under Tony Blair totally went along with Bush. And so, yeah, in terms of impacting me, I just remember thinking that the kind of journalism that was, you know, on display back then was not the kind of journalism I wanted to do. And I saw the consequences. I mean, I remember when Phil Donahue was fired because he was allowing critics of the war to come on. And that was a good window into how the U.S. media really works, is they don't allow space for genuine dissent. And so obviously that was a very formative time for me. And, it was incredible that the Bush administration was able to get away with that case when it was just such an obvious scam.
Yeah, and at the time you did see eventually some opposition to the war in the New York Times editorial pages from the likes of Paul Krugman, who is now he became like the biggest Russiagate stooge and like blue and non-conspiracist. But at the time there was, you know, there was some opposition. But for me, it was an opportunity to see how the media sold the public on a war using an intelligence deception that was spun out by defectors and by the intelligence agencies, and how it was stovepiped through various agencies in the government and then filtered out to the media, and then how these reporters enjoyed relationships behind closed doors with the architects of the war. Judith Miller, of course, takes the fall for all of this, but she wasn't alone. No. And she was teamed up, by the way, with Michael Gordon, who's still at the New York Times. But she was the one who was writing these bizarre quasi love letters with Scooter Libby, and really went going to the mat to protect her source, to the point where she went to prison. Here's Judith Miller today. Actually, I found this video, and I don't think it's really widely known that this video exists, but Judith Miller is still defending what she did during the Iraq War, and what she did was extremely consequential. I mean, but let's just let's just nail down the fact that the New York Times oversaw these stories. The New York Times edited them. They vetted them. They allowed Judith Miller to get away with this. So it's not just Judith Miller, but she's still out there defending her work.
The war in Iraq. It was all me. Okay, it was mostly me. I had some help from a clueless President George W. Bush and his neoconservative puppet master, Vice President Dick Cheney. Senior White House fanatics spoon-fed reporters like me cherry-picked intelligence about Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction so that America could invade Iraq and seize its oil. None of this is true, but many Americans continue to believe it. People died. It was a war. But President Bush didn't lie us into it.
It's just a war.
The false narrative that he did is itself a lie and deserves to be at last retired.
Okay, so she goes on for another 5 minutes at PragerU.
Unbelievable.
It's shocking. And it's shocking that she's still out there. She says the big lie is that Bush lied.
That's just mind blowing.
And I mean, there are people who still believe this. Like Liz Cheney teamed up with her father not long ago on a piece arguing that Saddam Hussein was in league with Al-Qaeda, in fact, and may have had WMD. We still see this thrown around. David Frum recently wrote, war criminal David Frum, he recently wrote that aside from Iraq's chemical weapons that could be fired by artillery shells, the WMD just weren't there. So he's basically saying there were WMD, and that wasn't there.
And what's their narrative? It's always, you know, we meant to do good, but we just didn't realize how broken Iraqi society was that couldn't handle our noble efforts to spread democracy and freedom. So we didn't properly factor in how Iraq was too primitive for our democracy promotion. That's basically the message from people like David Frum. By the way, interesting story about the whole chemical weapons allegation against Iraq. former guest on the Gray Zone on my show Pushback, Jose Bustani, he was the head of the OPCW at the time. And he was trying to prevent the U.S. invasion. So he offered to Iraq, why don't you come into the Chemical Weapons Convention, and that will subject you to regular inspections. And if you indeed have no chemical weapons, then that will undermine the case for war. And Iraq said, great. And they tried to sign on. John Bolton got word of that, went over to Bustani's office, said to him, we know where your kids live, and you have to back down on this. And if you don't, you have to resign. And Bustani said, I'm not going to resign. And that's when John Bolton said, you know, said, we know where your kids live. And then when Bustani still wouldn't back down, Bolton basically bullied enough member states to vote out Bustani, even though they had just renewed his tenure for a 5-year term. So the Bush administration was so determined to spread its lies that Iraq had chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction that they engineered the ouster of a senior diplomat who was standing in the way because he was trying to bring Iraq into the Chemical Weapons Convention where they could undergo regular inspections. And Bustani, you know, also has a connection to the OPCW whistleblower story because the OPCW whistleblowers who blew the whistle on a cover-up in Syria, they're so experienced that they were working at the OPCW back at the time when Bustani was being ousted. So he's come up and spoken in their defense. So it's just interesting how this comes full circle. And the fact that they went so far as to oust the head of the OPCW just to push their Iraq war lies, it speaks to what a joke it is to claim that, as Judith Miller does, that really the Bush administration didn't lie at all. That's wow. I'm speechless with that.
It was David Kaye. What happened with David Kaye in the UK? George Galloway's film on David Kaye deserves consideration. He argues that he was actually murdered because
he was a weapons inspector.
Well, he was the chief weapons investigator for Tony Blair, who was pushing the government's line until he realized it was a giant lie. Then he just goes off in the woods and blows his brains out.
Okay. It was a different name.
David though. Kelly. I'm sorry, David Kelly.
Yeah. There was a David Kaye who was a weapons inspector, but he passed away recently. But yeah, so
okay. My apologies to the family of David.
Let's get the name right. So it was David Kelly.
David Kelly. He was a scientist, an authority on biological warfare.
There you go.
He was working at Porton Down, which is the place that also analyzed the Skripal poisoning, and it's right there in Salisbury.
Yep.
So lots of intrigue, and David Kelly was said to have committed suicide July 17th, 2003, as the reality that Tony Blair and his team had completely lied to the British public about the case for war with Iraq was coming to light, and David Kelly. Well, I really would recommend watching George Galloway's film.
I haven't seen it. I got to watch it. I'm just learning now, just looking this up as you're talking about it.
That called Killing Kelly.
The day before Kelly died, he testified to the UK Parliament about Iraq WMDs. The day before he supposedly killed himself. Well, I'll definitely watch this movie, Killing Kelly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have Daily Mail actually entertaining evidence that David Kelly didn't commit suicide. Official explanation was that the weapons expert had taken his own life, but since Kelly's death, time has done nothing to dispel suspicion. Successive governments have refused to allow full coroner's inquest to be held. We have Hans Blix, who is also one of the key weapons inspectors, calling recently for Bush and Blair to be tried before the International Criminal Court. And I just want to make, because I know you have to go soon, and I want to get through one more quick segment. One point about the importance of the Iraq War for me. For a million Iraqis, it meant their death. For thousands of Americans, it meant their death in vain in a criminal war. For thousands more, it meant their lives were ruined. For their families, it meant their lives were ruined. It destabilized the region. It gave rise to ISIS. But for me, it educated me on what regime change really is. It is always fundamentally evil, and it will always fail. And the United States will always seek to destroy the entire state structure and destabilize a country because it doesn't actually seek the success of a country after regime change. It's all about destabilization and turning these countries into despotic netherworlds because
on a fundamental level, if there is a strong Iraqi central government that unites all the sects, it is going to participate in a multipolar world, and it is not going to be in its interest to be fully aligned with the US, and it is going to challenge the presence of Israel. So the lesson there also is that WMD was not a one-off lie that the American public was sold on. It was the blueprint for every regime change operation. Libya had the lie about Viagra being given to Libyan soldiers, about the fake massacre Gaddafi was going to commit in Benghazi, then the Syrian chemical attacks, which you've exposed, Aaron. That's Iraqi WMD. And Judith Miller, she's not some outlier. She's not a bad apple, as Abu Ghraib torturer Lindy England was said to be. She is the standard for the U.S. national security reporter. All they do is take controlled leaks and stenography for the U.S. intelligence services to sell these regime change wars to the American public. There are 1,000 Judith Millers running around in Washington, and then there are many more in the think tanks and on the staff of every member of Congress. This is the Iraq and George W. Bush himself. At the time, I feel like he's like this radical Texas cowboy Republican who wants to destroy the legacy of his dad. Yeah, there's is because his dad didn't go all the way. Yeah, there was an element of that. But Obama was really no different when it came to regime change wars. Nor is Joe Biden. I mean,
they just learned that they can't send in so many U.S. troops. And because they're going to lose the American public if people start coming home in body bags. So they really went into proxy wars in Syria and Libya. I mean, Syria in Libya, there was an air bombing, but in terms of the ground force, that was basically supporting an Al-Qaeda infused insurgency on the ground. And of course, same with Syria too, an Al-Qaeda dominated insurgency.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes. Yeah, so proxy wars are necessary for the U.S. or preferable for the U.S. because they eliminate the possibility of domestic political repercussions. As we see, you know, the Rage Against the War Machine rally or the rally coming up this weekend would be much, much bigger. I mean, by a factor of 100 if American soldiers were actually coming back in body bags. But the goal is the same, destruction and destabilization of all U.S. challengers, all independent countries. This is the Wolfowitz Doctrine. The Wolfowitz Doctrine is the blueprint. And it's why we see Victoria Nuland having so much control over the Biden administration's policy toward Ukraine and China to a certain extent. Who is she? The wife of Robert Kagan, who wrote the blueprint for the neoconservatives, the Project for a New American Centuries, plan for a benevolent empire. In other words, total U.S. control. It was basically an articulation of the Wolfowitz Doctrine for the neoconservative bipartisan intelligentsia. And it is now the official doctrine, I would say, of the Democratic Party and its foreign policy wing, including self-styled progressives like Matt Duss or Ro Khanna.
The neocons won. They can look back on this anniversary of the Iraq War, which should have destroyed them as a political entity for good. Instead, they've only gotten stronger. It's an incredible political achievement on their part. The fact that faction could preside over the Iraq War, the crime of the century, a huge disaster, and come out stronger 20 years later and actually enlist all the same forces that used to go out in the street and protest them in the Democratic Party. That's an amazing political achievement on their part.
Welcome back to Gray Zone Radio. It's Max Blumenthal. I've been talking with my colleague Aaron Mate at the Gray Zone about the 20th anniversary of the war in Iraq. We now turn to another terrible anniversary of an event 2 decades ago inside the Gaza Strip, the killing of the courageous American activist Rachel Corrie. Take a listen. America Firsters don't talk about it, but Israel gets more foreign aid than all other countries in Africa combined. And the circumstances or the events that took place at the same time as when the U.S. was invading Iraq were also extremely formative for me. Being a Jewish American growing up in Washington, D.C., although Zionism was not really taught or inculcated in my family, it was all around me, and you were expected to support Israel. And so watching the Second Intifada take place closely, I'm 45, I was in my early 20s then, so I was very politically conscious. That forced me to question literally everything, because both parties supported this savagery. We are also observing the 20th anniversary of the killing of Rachel Corrie. Rachel Corrie was an American activist who had gone to Palestine, to Gaza, as part of the International Solidarity Movement, which is a volunteer group that recruits Americans and Europeans to go basically stand guard, to stand in front of Palestinians as their homes are facing demolition by Israeli D9 Caterpillar bulldozers. I've seen them in the West Bank at Palestinian protests against the apartheid wall, which is being built through their farms. These volunteers stand as essentially, I don't want to call them human shields, but to use their presence to deter Israeli military violence against these farmers who are protesting for their land. But let's hear from Rachel Corrie just days before her death, as she explained why she was in Gaza. She was in the southern, outside the southern city of Rafah, which I visited and which was facing massive violence from the Israeli military, where civilian homes were just simply being bulldozed for being there. I'll explain that in a second.
I've been here for about a month and a half now, and this is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. In the time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed. On the 30th of January, the Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. Every few days, if not every day, houses are demolished here. People are economically devastated because of the closure of the borders into Egypt and the extreme control of the Gazan economy by Israel. I came to look at the aftermath of a place where 25 greenhouses had been demolished on the other side of Rafah, destroying the livelihoods of about 300 people. And that had taken place while they rounded up about 150 men, held them under a sniper tower and shot around them to contain the men, the farmers in the area. So I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive. And that is incredibly horrifying.
Well, that's Rachel Corrie speaking from Rafah, and you can hear the sound of bulldozers around her. This was just days before, I believe it was days before she died. And how did what those bulldozers were doing was they were demolishing all of these homes in what's known as the Philadelphia Corridor, which is the closest area to the Egyptian border, because Ariel Sharon was obsessed with tunnels, which allowed Gaza to be supplied mostly with civilian goods, but also he believed weapons were coming in. So if you lived there, they were just going to create what they called a buffer zone and destroy your home. And they were destroying innocent people's homes. She had been come very close to one family. The father was a doctor. He was a local physician. And an Israeli bulldozer was barreling forward toward his home, and she decided to take a stand. She stood in front of the bulldozer, waved her hands. The bulldozer driver could clearly see her, and she fell. The bulldozer kept going, and it crushed her to death as other ISM volunteers were attempting to wave to the bulldozer to stop. And that house was eventually bulldozed. As I said, her death really helped galvanize my sense of anti-Zionism, my opposition to Israeli apartheid, and it sent me on this journey that I've been on in journalism and activism along with the invasion of Iraq. But it was the killing of Rachel Corrie that helped really, me really crystallize my understanding of what Israel was all about. Aaron.
Aaron, and you put it into a great book called Goliath, which is essential for understanding how depraved Israeli society is. And that was a formative book for a lot of people. I think, you know, the same epiphanies or realizations you had, Max, I think you helped, you channeled that into your book, and I think helped inform a lot of people in the U.S. And around the world into what the reality of what Israel was. But for me, I remember hearing about Rachel Corrie. And at the time I was already involved in university with my, there was a really active Palestinian group at the school I went to called Concordia. And they were called Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. And they sort of introduced me to activism. I was already political at that time, but they really showed me what it took to be courageous. Like they were very brave in putting on events and bringing in speakers and not catering to, you know, to Zionist talking points. They were unapologetic in standing up for Palestinian rights, and they got a lot done in the context of our school and having an influence on the discussion in Montreal, where Concordia is. And so that was very formative for me. And I remember the media at that time just reading about, like, the way you would read about the Intifada as it was going on was it was between two equal sides, which was just such a joke. I mean, You had in the first weeks of the Intifada, Israel opening fire massively on, you know, people who were largely unarmed and killing them in huge numbers. Like the death toll, like the ratio of dead in the Intifada was massively in Israel's favor, just in killing, you know, civilians constantly. And Rachel Corrie became among the casualties, and her bravery. I mean, imagine being, she was what, 23 years old, 20, 22 or around that age, being that age and or being any age and standing up, being that courageous to put your body on the line like that and trying to use her privilege as an American to try to, you know, defend a Palestinian family from the brutality that her own government was sponsoring. And she paid the price with her life, and she was a martyr. And of course, how did the U.S. Congress react to all this? How did they treat her family? I mean, you know the story better than I, Max. They threw the whole Corrie family under the bus.
Yeah. Well, I also should mention that she was not the only ISM volunteer who was killed in that area. Tom Herndl, the British activist, was shot in the head by an Israeli sniper and killed on site. The sniper faced no disciplinary procedure at all, as far as I know. Tom Herndl's mother attended my talk in Parliament at Portcullis House, that where I was hosted by Jeremy Corbyn and his staff, or Jeremy Corbyn's staff, in 2015. And I got to meet his mother, Joyce Herndl, incredibly nice woman. And when you get to meet the parents of these people who are your age, who are just like you, it's devastating. I also got to meet Rachel Corrie's parents, Craig and Cindy Corrie, in a courtroom in Haifa, Israel, where they were suing the Israeli government for $1 for a simple admission of guilt that they knowingly killed their daughter. And of course, that was thrown out. And I had to sit in the courtroom with them. And then we spent time afterwards with their lawyer as they reviewed footage of their daughter being killed over and over again in order to argue the case that the bulldozer driver saw their daughter. So imagine watching your own child be killed again and again and again in order to extract justice from a foreign government, and your own government doing absolutely nothing to support you. In 2003, the House introduced a resolution calling for justice for Rachel Corrie, for a serious U.S. investigation into the death. The House International Relations Committee introduced it, and Ileana Ross Leighton, who is the right-wing Cuban from the Miami area, blocked the bill, and she's one of AIPAC's closest allies. I mean, her campaigns were solidly funded by the Israel lobby. So that just shows where the U.S. stands on Israel. And the whole story of, like, Rachel Corrie, her body was defiled by an Israeli pathologist named Yehuda Hiss, who is notorious for actually extracting organs and, like, the corneas from Israelis and Palestinians alike. And he was accused of using them for medical research. He's a notorious figure in Israel. I mean, the U.S. did nothing about any of this, and all this had to come out in court. So the people continue to go to Palestine from the U.S. to follow in Rachel Corrie's footsteps. And I would encourage anyone watching now, if you're a young person, you're looking for something to do with your summer coming up, and you have the resources to do it, go be a volunteer, go get out there and see what's going on in the West Bank, because the rampage continues.
This was another episode of Gray Zone Radio. I've been your host, Max Blumenthal. To see more of our work, check out thegrayzone.com. That's GRAYzone.com. And sign up for our newsletter. This episode was produced by Christopher Weaver.
Hi, this is Michael Novick, Interim General Manager of KPFK. I'll be doing a report to the listener this Wednesday evening at 5 p.m. I'll be joined by Dan McCrory and several other members of the Community Advisory Board. We'll be talking with you about what's happening at the station, the prospective move to new quarters, and other issues that have been coming up. And you can find out more about what the role of the Community Advisory Board is. We'll be taking your calls during the broadcast. This is part of the mandated monthly management report to the listeners, and we hope to have a dialogue with you about your concerns and what we can do to ensure the future of KPFK is bright and successful. So please tune in again this Wednesday, March 22nd at 5 p.m. for the monthly general manager report to the listener. Thanks for listening to KPFK, and don't forget to donate at kpfk.org.
You know, maybe $75 is the right amount for you to give to KPFK. That $75 comes out to exactly 21 cents a day, and that pays for a lot of programming on KPFK. Hours of intelligent news every day on Democracy Now! And local news, local politics and culture from Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Entertaining, thoughtful shows like The Global Village, The Car Show, and Pacifica Performance Showcase. Your support makes them all possible, which is why KPFK needs your contribution right now. Tom Hartman here, reminding you that your contribution of $75 helps pay for programs that make KPFK a unique and essential part of life in Southern California. Give online at kpfk.org or call right now, 818-985-2711. 818-985-2711. Thank you.
Hey, this is Aloe Black, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM, San Diego County, 99.5 FM, Ridgecrest, China Lake, and streaming online at kpfk.org.
Feeling my way through the darkness, guided by a beating heart.